good to go, Frieda.
Okay, thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, very good. It is an honor to speak to you about the current struggles inside Iran, to speak to a conference on Marxism 2021. In the interest of time, I'm going to read out my presentation because I don't want to go over the allotted time. This is a critical moment in the Middle East and North Africa region. China and Iran have just signed a $400 billion 25-year economic and military agreement, which practically turns Iran into a colony of China. At the same time, while the U.S. continues to impose brutal sanctions on Iran for its nuclear and missile program, it is eager to make a deal with the Islamic Republic to restore a version of the 2015 nuclear agreement. In Afghanistan, the U.S. is putting power in the hands of the Taliban after the almost 20 years of U.S. military occupation. In Iraq, it is eager to end its 18-year occupation. In its competition with China for global capitalist dominance, the U.S. wants to concentrate its forces in the Pacific region, where it does not rule out open military confrontation with China. In the meantime, in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, Israel, and Turkey, which have been traditional U.S. allies, are entering new deals with each other and with China and Russia. We also have to confront the fact that on the 10th anniversary of the Syrian uprising, and just 2 years after a series of popular uprisings in Sudan, Algeria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran, Syria lies in ruins. Half of its population has been displaced, and over 500,000 of its people have been killed, mostly by the brutal authoritarian rule of the Assad regime, with the support of Russia and Iran, and to a smaller extent by the brutal forces of ISIS and other jihadist and religious fundamentalist forces in the region. The large majority of the populations of countries involved in the 2011 wave of uprisings or the 2019 wave are also facing deepening poverty, unemployment, authoritarianism, and the spread of COVID. Iran in particular has experienced three waves of mass protests in the last decade. The 2009 Green Movement against the fraudulent election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was mainly a reformist movement demanding that votes be counted. The 2017 and the 2019-2020 uprisings had a mass working class character and were led by unemployed youth, women, labor struggles, and oppressed minorities. They were protests against religious fundamentalism, state exploitation, its domestic injustices, and its regional imperialist interventions in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. According to Reuters, after the 2019 uprising, at least 1,500 people were killed by the Iranian regime, and over 7,000, mostly youth, were arrested. Most of those who were arrested are still languishing in prison under horrible conditions. Several have been executed. Many are contracting COVID. There is no doubt that the Iranian population is suffering greatly as a result of U.S. sanctions imposed by the Trump administration and mostly continued by the Biden administration. However, there is a lot more to be said about the reasons for the suffering of the Iranian masses and the context and history of the 2019 and 2020 uprising. The Iranian state needs to be understood as a case of militarized state capitalism acting as a regional imperialist power in the Middle East. In many ways, it has continued the general direction of the economy of the previous Pahlavi regime. In other words, it is a statist economy characterized by the unity of industry and the army. Since the 1979 Iranian Revolution, however, Ayatollah Khomeini and his followers who established the Islamic Republic have used Ayatollah Khomeini died in 1989, but that whole establishment has used an anti-US imperialist discourse to destroy any progressive and revolutionary opposition to their repression and to co-opt part of the Iranian and global left. After the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted from 1980 to 1988, as long as oil income was plentiful, this regime spent a portion of its profits on building infrastructure, health, education, and giving benefits to a large part of the working class, so long as they abided by its fundamentalist ideology. However, over time, more and more of the oil income started going toward militarism at the expense of the extreme poverty of the masses. The current economic crisis is caused first and foremost by Iran's military and political interventions in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. Iran has also spent billions of dollars on its nuclear and missile programs. These militarist expenditures and U.S. sanctions together have brought the country to the verge of economic collapse. In addition, Iran is facing severe environmental problems such as water shortage, deforestation, and floods caused by rapacious capitalist practices. Who are the progressive forces of opposition inside Iran? The progressive forces are among workers, women, oppressed national minorities, students, and intellectuals. In today's panel, Simone White will discuss current labor struggles, and I will focus on the explicitly feminist struggles of women and the situation of oppressed national minorities, all of which also overlap with student, youth, environmental, and political prisoner struggles. I will also discuss the role of Iranian socialists and the importance of international solidarity. Women in Iran face discrimination, violence, and second-class status as daughters, wives, mothers, students, employees, unemployed workers, or part-timers, and face even more discrimination if they are members of an oppressed national or religious minority. However, they also represent 60% of university students. They have published a wide variety of novels, and when possible, express themselves in blogs and websites, hold study groups, forums, and publish translations of works by international feminists. Most of you have seen images of girls of Revolution Avenue, brave women who, starting in 2017, climbed on utility boxes and took off their headscarves in public. They were against the mandatory hijab and believed that a woman's choice of clothing should be hers and not imposed by the state or any institution. The majority of women who took off their headscarves in public were arrested, and some are still in prison now, serving long sentences. However, women's struggles have continued in various forms. On March 8, just 3 weeks ago, International Women's Day, women held small gatherings around the country, opposed new legislation which bans birth control, demanded access to birth control, abortion rights, opposed gender violence and femicide, demanded economic, political, and social equality, and called for the release of political prisoners. Since the fall of 2020, we have also seen a budding Me Too movement in Iran, which has targeted artists, writers, academics, army leaders, and members of the parliament, as well as abusive fathers, uncles, brothers. This is a very brave act in a society in which any talk of having been sexually abused or raped is taboo and will lead to being stigmatized for life. Women political prisoners have become an important symbol of feminist struggles in Iran. Most notable is Nasrina Sotoudeh, a brave human rights attorney who was sentenced to 38 years in prison and 148 lashes for having defended the girls of Revolution Avenue. She has been in and out of jail and on hunger strike multiple times since 2010, and has also contracted COVID. A powerful documentary about her was recently produced by the U.S. filmmakers Jeff Kaufman and Marsha Ross, and you can get more information about that by going to the website nasreenfilm.com. Another recently released feminist political prisoner, Nargese Mohammadi, was serving a long sentence for opposing the death penalty and defending the rights of children. She has just published a book in Persian, of course, in exile, by a publisher in exile. She's still inside Iran. So she has just published a book in Persian entitled White Torture, which contains interviews with women political prisoners. Zeynab Jalalian, a Kurdish woman political prisoner, is among various Kurdish and Arab women who have been imprisoned for defending the rights of women and national minorities. Sepide Golian, a young woman journalist, is serving a long sentence for covering and defending the strikes of sugarcane workers in the southern province of Khuzestan. She continues to write from inside prison walls about the terrible situation of women prisoners from the Arab ethnic minority. Kylie Moore Gilbert, an Australian scholar of the Middle East, was held as a political prisoner in Iran's Evin prison for more than 2 years and was recently released. There are so many other women political prisoners as well as social prisoners who are suffering under intolerable conditions in Iran. Within the past few years, there have been several new waves of mass arrests of Kurdish, Arab, and most recently Baluchi activists and intellectuals. Various activists from these national minorities have been executed. The Iranian regime also murders destitute Kurdish and Baluch workers who daily cross the border to carry cargo, including fuel, on their backs in order to earn a meager living. These assaults and murders are further manifestations of a history of oppression of national minorities in Iran. Baluchistan, Khuzestan, and Kurdistan are the poorest provinces in the country, the most neglected, the most environmentally damaged, while their labor and natural resources are exploited to promote the Iranian regime's militarism and regional interventions. Khuzestan and Kurdistan were also the provinces that had the strongest participation during the 2017 and 2019-2020 uprisings. What we see in Iran today is that, on the one hand, the regime's crisis of legitimacy and the current economic collapse should make it exceedingly difficult for this regime to stay in power. On the other hand, the lack of articulation of a socialist, humanist, and revolutionary alternative to the inhumanity of capitalism, religious fundamentalism, misogyny, racial, ethnic, and religious prejudice has created a void with no motivating vision of the future. Within the Iranian left, the needed socialist vision, analysis, and organizing that would build on the 2017 and 2019 uprisings and offer a genuine alternative to capitalism, particularly patriarchy and chauvinism, has been very weak. New efforts, mostly by the younger generation of Iranian socialists, to oppose Iranian nationalism and militarized state capitalism, to defend women's rights, LGBT rights, the rights of Iran's oppressed minorities, and to address the connections between militarism and the assaults on the standard of living at home, are starting to be made. The socialist left was highly active at the time of the 1979 Iranian Revolution and had thousands of followers. However, unfortunately, it consisted mostly of Stalinist and Maoist brands of the left and a much smaller section of independent leftists. Most socialists were taken by Khomeini's anti-imperialist discourse and did not support or only mildly and briefly supported the initial massive women's International Women's Day protests against the Islamic Republic in March of 1979. Only small sectors of the left supported the Kurds, who rose up in a rebellion in March of 1979 and demanded self-determination and challenged the counter-revolutionary direction of the Islamic Republic. The result was that up to 10,000 Kurdish activists were executed by the Iranian government between 1979 and 1983. By the spring of 1981, Iranian leftists were subjected to a full-scale assault by the Iranian government. Even the Tudeh Party, which was backed by the USSR, and which continued to support the regime until 1983, was not spared. Thousands of leftists were imprisoned and executed in the 1980s. Today, Iranian socialists are much smaller in number. Of the 1979 generation, many of those who survived the arrests and executions were forced into exile and have abandoned socialism. Nevertheless, there are some important efforts by Iranian socialists and progressives in exile who are publishing websites that promote free thinking and human rights. Socialists inside Iran also face the very real limitations of living under an authoritarian police state, but still make courageous efforts in translating books and articles or publishing articles on various websites and blogs. Within the new generation of Iranian socialists, there has been more interest in the philosophical dimension of Marxism and the types of Marxism that have been critical of the USSR and Maoist China. A variety of works by Marx or by humanist and independent Marxists have been translated into Persian during the past 20 years. It can be argued, however, that three major shortcomings of the previous generation of socialists still remain within the Iranian left. And those are statism, Iranian nationalism, and sexism. So I will say a bit about each. First, in contrast to Marx, who saw the abolition of alienated labor and of alienated human relations as the foundation of a socialist society, for most Iranian socialists, socialism is still merely defined by abolishing the private ownership of property and markets. Hence, state ownership of capital is viewed as progress and a move away from capitalism, even if the state is the employer extracting surplus value from workers. The proposed version or the proposed vision of an alternative to capitalism mostly does not go beyond a version of state capitalism with some degree of collective bargaining and worker self-management. Nevertheless, there have been efforts to challenge this by Marxists who advocate a reading of Marx's value theory from the vantage point of his analysis of alienated labor. Secondly, Iranian nationalism is deeply etched within the psyche of those Iranians who consider themselves Persian. Considering that Iran is a country consisting also of Kurds, Arabs, Azeris, Baluchis, Lurs, and Turkmens, no progressive pathway can be charted without some form of autonomy or self-determination, which at least recognizes the rights of minorities to instruction in their mother tongue and the right to have some say about the use of their natural resources. However, in Iran, any discussion of autonomy or self-determination is immediately labeled as separatism and dismissed by most Persian intellectuals. Iranian nationalism has also been the main reason for the shameful silence of the majority of Iranian socialist intellectuals about their state's military interventions in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. Some leftists support Bashar Assad and repeat the Iranian government's claim that it intervened in Syria to stop ISIS and other Sunni fundamentalists. Others have defended Assad as the lesser of the two evils. Thirdly, sexism is deeply ingrained in Iranian society as it is in most societies. The Islamic Republic, from its inception in 1979, took advantage of this and offered men benefits such as temporary marriage and the abolition of the meager rights that women had gained under the previous Pahlavi regime's family law. Thus, even socialist men who argue for a non-statist and emancipatory Marxism find it hard to refuse the benefits that the Islamic Republic offers them when it comes to exploiting and oppressing their spouse and her girlfriends. So long as these issues are not addressed and overcome, Iranian socialists will not be able to offer a genuine liberatory socialist alternative to capitalism, imperialism, sexism, and chauvinism. This issue of crafting a vision and perspective for the movement is also why international socialist solidarity is critically important. The global left has a responsibility to reach out to the Iranian protesters, hold Iran's brutal regime accountable for its murders, call for the immediate release of the over 7,000 detained protesters, as well as several hundred other political prisoners who have been languishing in prisons prior to the 2019 uprising. We have a responsibility to uplift the struggles and demands of feminists, labor activists, environmentalists, progressive and democratic intellectuals, and oppressed minority groups such as the Kurds, ethnic Arabs, Baha'is, Sufis, Baluchis, and the LGBTQ community. Socialists in countries that still have democratic rights can play an important role. We can create awareness of the struggles inside Iran and connect them to struggles in our country or region, and at the same time, promote dialogue on an affirmative vision of an alternative. With that goal in mind, I would like to end my presentation with four specific ways in which Australian socialists can promote solidarity with struggles inside Iran. One, you can challenge Australian socialists who still cover over the repressive rule of the Islamic Republic and the Assad regime in the name of so-called anti-imperialism. Two, you can write about and publicize the cases of Iranian political prisoners and highlight the variety of labor, feminist, oppressed minority, and student views and experiences that they represent. Three, you can draw connections between the struggles against gender violence and rape in Australia and the struggle against gender violence and femicide in Iran. Four, you can facilitate communication between Australian, Chinese, Burmese, Thai, Indonesian, and Iranian labor, feminist, and human rights activists. I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you, Frieda. And I'd add to the ways that people can show solidarity, people that are doing, you know, just being mindful of labor struggles and union struggles that you're involved in, and expressing solidarity with some of the struggles which might be happening in Iran or the particular labor unions, which has actually happened, which I'll actually refer to just briefly. In what I'm about to say, which is that that I'm going to add some information now that zooms in more specifically on the situation of the labor movement in Iran, which has been developing in the context of all the terrain that Frieda just covered in relation to the political and economic social situation in Iran and Iran's growth as a regional power in the Middle East. All these factors have shaped and produced the more recent explosions of working class struggle that have really intensified, escalated, broadened and deepened, particularly in the past 5 years. A high point of the intensification of these struggles has been the growing rate of strikes of workers in Iran in recent years, from sort of 2017, particularly coinciding with the bigger, more militant anti-regime, anti-government protests that started to kick off then. And these strikes escalated in the middle of last year, in the middle of 2020, into a nationwide strike wave. It drew in over 10,000 workers from the oil and gas sector, the petrochemical sector of the Iranian economy, which, as people know, has historically been a major source of wealth for the Iranian regime, wealth extracted from vast gas and oil deposits in Iran. And then as well as those very powerful workers from the petrochemical sector, the other workers out on strike as part of this more generalised nationwide strike wave included workers in the health sector, so lots of nurses' actions, some doctors as well, but a lot of women nurses. Remembering this is in the context of a monstrous wave of COVID in Iran. It's actually the worst COVID situation in the region, in the Middle East. Teachers, car manufacturing workers, agriculture workers, miners, steel workers, and then a whole bunch of other trades workers like builders, plumbers, electricians, welders, pipe fitters, who work on the oil and gas fields and make up part of that workforce in the petrochemical sector. Them, alongside transport workers, cooks, you know, food prep workers, drivers, and so those other workers that work in the oil and gas sector, they were all out on strike, and many, many more workers in what is now the most significant nationwide strike movement that has taken place since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. Like all strike waves and prolonged explosions of militant protests of workers that take place anywhere in the world under capitalism, the development and revival of the labour movement in Iran has not just come out of nowhere. The nationwide strike movement that intensified midway through last year developed because of a series of factors. Firstly, because of the trajectory and worsening of a set of political and economic conditions specific to Iranian capitalism that Frida has spoken about, and to some extent also the situation of capitalism in the region. But alongside those factors, very importantly, because of the leading role of certain sections of workers in Iran in organising struggles and strikes and the formation of independent unions, which are illegal, not just in recent years, but really going back to the early 2000s, and I think you could probably argue even into the latter part of the 1990s. There were some strikes, waves of strikes and protests then in response to the Iranian regime's project of starting to introduce anti-worker neoliberal reforms, which, like elsewhere throughout the Middle East and, as we know, across the world, ramped up in the 1990s and attacked workers in quite specific ways in the Middle East, in some ways in quite specific ways across the region of the Middle East, and sorry, Iran. The reforms and attacks that the regime has imposed on workers in Iran have not just been part of a neoliberal phase of capitalism, but they've also been part of a campaign to crush the revolutionary consciousness and organising of workers that reached its high point in the Iranian Revolution of 1979. The actual attacks, there were a bunch of strategies, but one of them, in terms of attacking the labour movement and workers, came in the form of a law called the Labour Law of 1990. It formally banned independent trade unions and it legalised the use of short-term contracts by employers and for the regime at any time to define what the length of short-term contracts would be. And then what the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps did, and the IRGC is the most powerful section of the Iranian military, Frida's written about it and called them really that they're the de facto state in Iran. They've become an industrial empire. What they did, and then the entirety of the regime from the clerical elite at the top, the military and any government that's been in power, whether they're conservatives or the so-called moderate factions, what they've done since the 1990s has been to privatise massive sections of previously state-owned industry, then to create these labour hire companies that are effectively extensions of the state. They're extensions of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So together, they've enforced the use of these short-term contracts or just the practice of employing workers on no contracts, so therefore no benefits. The outcome of which, and many other types of attacks, has been to smash workers' conditions, rights and wages, with the practice of just not paying people wages for months and months being rife in Iran. And the point of this for the military, for the regime, has been to siphon massive amounts of revenues back into the bank accounts of the military, of the IRGC, to finance the project of the Iranian regime constructing itself as a major regional imperialist power. And we're talking tens of billions upon billions of dollars of stolen wealth from the working class in Iran. that, like, people have tried to estimate how many hundreds of billions of dollars it is, and obviously it's such a secretive practice that we don't quite know. And, of course, they haven't just siphoned it into their war chest. It's made a bunch of sections of the clerical elite, the generals and some private capitalists filthy, filthy rich. And that matters to understand because it's part of what has shaped the consciousness, the rage and industrial actions and protests of millions and millions of Iranian workers now. The scales have rapidly fallen from people's eyes, and the rage and anger that people have is now being directed at all sections of the regime in Iran. And I'm going to quote something that Frieda wrote that summarises this. I think it's an excellent summary. Given the dire economic situation in the country, the brutal repression of the November 2019 protests, and the current COVID-19 pandemic, most Iranians have realised that they are being robbed to pay for wars, arms, and dangerous nuclear and missile programs that have brought the country to the point of economic collapse. And I think the other thing that's important to add is the extreme poverty of Iranians. 60% of Iranians now live under the poverty line, meaning that people can't afford to eat. Like, it's really important to understand how absolutely brutal and dire the situation of poverty is, how this transfer of wealth has translated into people having to sleep on the roofs of buildings, sleeping in open graves. Like, this is actually the reality of how impoverished 60% of the population of tens of millions of people is. A bunch of people here might have heard of a group of workers in Iran called the Haftapa sugarcane workers. And I want to reference them specifically and some other particular groups of workers like the Tehran Bus Workers Union in turning now to the strikes and protests that have been taking place, because these workers and some other groups of workers like the teachers and the teachers union in Iran, and another group of retired workers actually from the Free Union of Iranian workers, have actually been really a vanguard amongst the working class in Iran, not just in recent years and in 2020, but actually going back now some decades. So into the latter half of the 1990s, when the regime is intensifying its neoliberal anti-worker attacks, there's the beginnings of some worker actions and strikes. So there's actually several strikes in 1995 of workers for non-payment of salaries, this thing of not getting paid for 3 months or 6 months. And then between December 96 and February 97, there's a wave of protests and strikes started by oil workers in Tehran, Tabriz, Esfahan and Shiraz. State repression silenced those strikes, but then in September of 1997, workers in a region called Arak went on strike, again claiming their unpaid salaries, and they won that strike. And the regime had to mandate the employers to pay their wages. Then in the early 2000s, workers from the Tehran Bus Workers Union and the Haftapa Sugarcane Union, they start to become really active. And I'm going to outline a couple of examples of what they do, because they are absolutely heroic. I think they're also, well, they're inspiring and instructive, but they give us a sense of how sections of workers, how particular sections of workers taking a lead can energise, politicise and start to build confidence amongst wider layers of workers. And in the context of Iran, they do it, and they're doing it now in the face of absolutely barbaric, widespread violence, torture, assassinations and also imprisonment and also the widespread targeting of the family members of labour union leaders and militants. So the Tehran Bus Workers Union is a union of 17,000 workers in Tehran, and it was an active revolutionary union in the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And also workers from the Haftapa sugarcane complex, which I'll get to. There are people there who were participants in workers' councils in the revolution in 1979. Now, that matters, obviously, right? There's political traditions, anti-capitalist politics, and the experience and understanding of workers' councils from the revolution of 1979. So the lived experience of you can take over running your factory and your workplace, and to some extent starting to organise, the your own society. There's those traditions that live on in these unions via some of the workers. So the regime bans independent unions as part of the counter-revolution when the Islamic Republic was established. And the result of that was that the Tehran Bus Workers Union had to operate underground, and they did so until about 2004, when they start to begin to openly organise around some of the grievances of bus drivers. And it's really heroic stuff. There are some particular union militants and leaders in the union, like a man called Mansour Osunlu. You could just do a talk just about this guy, and to be honest, like hundreds, maybe thousands of other union militants in Iran over the past several decades. He's a founding member of the Tehran Bus Workers Union. He's a very popular unionist amongst workers, who, as well as hundreds, if not thousands, of other bus driver unionists and their family members, withstands multiple imprisonments between 2005 to 2008, savage torture. He loses his eyesight in one eye as a result of injuries that he sustained being attacked by state security services at a protest in 2005, and then not being given treatment in hospital when he was in hospital. He leads this kind of strike, this industrial action in 2005, it's really like a really courageous, you know, action against the regime, where bus drivers in Tehran refuse to collect fares. He's sent in 2009 to this notorious jail in Iran called Evin Prison. He's incarcerated for 5 years, during which time he organises the guard workers in the jail to organise their own union, and then to organise industrial action against their bosses for not paying their wages for months and months, and they win that struggle. So this is the kind of stuff that's happening in the Tehran Bus Workers Union. I would add that as part of his torture, the regime slit his tongue in half. This man continues to... and he was also... This is a man who's so well-known in the international trade union movement that he was supported by the Australian Maritime Union, who expressed, you know, messages of solidarity and stuff. So it really matters if you're a unionist to express solidarity with worker militants like this. The Haftapa Sugarcane Workers Union was established in 1974. So it's another union that exists prior to the revolution, right? And it's got a really similar history of heroic struggle in recent decades. There's about 5,000 workers at the sugarcane factory complex in Shush, in the southwest of Iran. And they work in the oldest sugarcane factory in Iran. It was established in 1961. And they've basically been on strike every month for the past 4 years, demanding unpaid wages, the reinstatement of worker militants that have been sacked, and for an end to the company's privatisation. They've organised a heap of successful strikes, especially between 2005 to 2007. So remember that. You know, we're talking 10 years ago now. These are the kind of usual trajectories that it takes to build up confidence, you know, amongst layers of workers anywhere, is years and years and years and years of keep on pushing against your bosses, keep on pushing against a dictatorship, right? They last year were on strike alongside this other, you know, as part of the nationwide strike of workers for 41 days. So this is around the same time that the 10,000 all workers are on strike, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the other workers that were on strike in a minute. And what I want to do is read you one of their statements, because if we think back to what Frieda was talking about in terms of the absolutely violent repression of national minorities in Iran, this gives you a sense of what a leading group of workers in Iran looks like and what they're trying to do to unite the working class. And it's important to say that they've built up such support, and I'll show you some pictures in a minute, within Shush, which is the town that they live, that it's not just they go on strike, it's like the whole of Shush, you know, like where they live. People come out into the streets, support their strikes, you know, and so on. This is what they said last year. The only way we're going to win anything is stay united, 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 no matter what our differences might be. When we move forward as a united force, then everyone will benefit. We must never permit ourselves to make decisions individually. All decisions need to be made collectively about the demands we want to make and about who we make these demands on. The bosses want us to be at each other's throats, creating divisions between decibel and Arab, shower and lure, Arab and lure. We have now been going on strike every month for the past 4 years. Enough is enough. We must have solidarity and stay united if we are going to win. Haftapa has been looked upon as a model for successful strike action by workers around the world. Why? Because we've managed to stay united and in solidarity. I'm just realising that I haven't got a lot of time left, so I'm going to try to summarise a couple of things. And I'm not going to have time to talk about this in much detail now, but what I want to emphasise as well is the leading role of teacher unionists and the leaders of the teacher union. So just like, so it's important to say, half of the Iranian teaching workforce are women, obviously. Oh, no, I'm coming to the slides. Yep. Half of the Iranian teaching workforce are women. A bunch of their leading members have also been imprisoned, are still in prison at this point. And then there's a woman that I want to give some particular attention to just briefly. I'm not going to have time to talk about her heap. She's absolutely incredible. Her name is Parvin, Mohammadi. She is this incredible Labor militant who was born in 1961. She became a Labor leader, a militant Labor leader, in every union, in every workplace that she joined. So firstly, a shoe factory. She leads that factory of workers in strikes. Then she joins a steel company, and as a woman with a company of over 2,000 workers, for just over a decade, she just becomes a leader of all these strikes, which means facing down the regime. When she was in the shoe factory at one point, the regime sent tanks to arrest and torture this woman and all these other workers in the shoe factory that had occupied the factory. So she ended up becoming, not that long ago, the deputy chair, I think, anyway, second in charge of the free worker, the union of the Free Union of Iranian Workers in Iran, and they are actually a union that represents retired workers who have been extremely active in really militant protests against the regime because they're not getting paid pensions. So you work your whole life, you don't get paid your bloody wages and salary for 3 to 6 months, then you retire and you don't get paid your pension. There's been a warrant put out for her arrest. She's been in hiding since December of last year. So it gives you some sense of the heroism of these people and what it actually takes to take on a dictatorship. I really don't have a lot of time now to go through this, but what I want to just show you is a bit of a glimpse of what the protest situation and the strikes look like. So in Iran, there's this thing, well, firstly, it's very hard to get information. So what I started to find when I started to dig into the information about the actual strikes that are taking place is that there are so many. There are so many, and obviously because of the censorship of the regime and the repression and the danger of being exposed as being involved in the strikes, you can only assume that there's so many more and, you know, all sorts of things going on that we don't know about, right? So 2019, we see 3,530 protests in Iran. That's 294 a day, a month, 10 a day. Of those, they reckon about 1,411 were strikes. Now, in the literature about strikes and protests in Iran, they use the word protests and strikes interchangeably. So you have to sort of think that when they say, sometimes they specifically say strikes, and there's all these pictures and evidence of strikes, but we have to be mindful that protesting and striking goes hand in hand in Iran. So what they do is they go on strike, but then they all like picket, right? They all turn up and protest outside the bosses, outside the workplace, and they also protest the regime. The important thing about that is it's 150 cities and 30 provinces all around Iran. Just wait for the next slide. These slides will demonstrate to you very visually why I became a social worker and not a graphic designer. Then in 2020, you get this escalation to this number of protests, 4,482, 373 a month. Now, this is in the context of COVID, right? So you've got to think, without COVID, like the whole thing could have just been, who knows how much more explosive, yeah? That's the demands of workers. I've talked about that a lot. For unpaid wages, against privatisation, against poor sanitation and a lack of safety equipment. So the health workers are out protesting for PPE and all the stuff related to COVID, against poverty wages and a bunch of other economic grievances. Here's some of the chants for the protests of workers that are on strike and also in these militant protests. So you get a sense, right? You get a sense. Like, you think about the repression that people have experienced and the grip that the regime, this dictatorship, has had on people for such a long time, and look at some of those chants, right, widespread across the country. And so then you get a sense of there's the political starting to intersect with the economic stuff, yeah, which is really exciting. Now, here's just a glimpse of some of the strikers out on work. So here's some of the oil workers. They have mass meetings as parts of the strike. That's some more of the oil workers. Here's some iron ore miners. 3,500 workers were on strike in this place for over a month for not having been paid their wages. They're coal mining workers, yeah? Think about the power of these workers. This is a massive cement factory where there were thousands of workers on strike. These are people who work for the regime. They're infrastructure workers on strike. Here's the municipal workers in Sahin Shah, which is in central Iran, and they were part... So those protests of municipal workers who were like water workers happened in 69 cities in Iran at the same time, right? Here's women, these are teachers, and here's teachers and nurses out in on strike in unison with the oil workers. Here's the sugarcane workers. So this gives you a sense of what happens when the strike happens, yeah? And they march through the streets of Shush with all of their supporters, their family members, in the face of the military staring them down. Here are their supporters, you know, people across the community getting organised. And I'm going to finish up by just giving you a bit of a sense of what sort of cross-nation organising now is starting to take place in terms of uniting all these struggles. So it's very much in its infancy, right? Like, we have to recognise that. To some extent, it's been an organic, you know, generalised strike wave. But the leading worker militants and the workers' groups that I've just talked about are trying, alongside some socialist students and radical students from universities across Iran, and some other activists, to start to try to actually get some coordination happening and planning happening for the strikes. If anyone wants to read this whole statement, it's so inspiring. And it's obviously, like, the people who are leading this are the Tehran Bus Workers Union and the Haftapa people. But I'll just give you a bit of a set of, like, here's the last paragraph. So we, the signatories of this statement, while supporting workers' protests and strikes, and their demands for pay increases, immediate payment of unpaid wages, elimination of subcontractors, elimination of temporary and blank work contracts, and most important of all, elimination of privatisation in all spheres of society, declare that workers' unity in action and strike and establishment of independent workers' organisation is the most crucial element for working class advancement. And realisation of this monumental task requires, what does that say? I don't know why I'm reading off there and not you. Support and the unity of diverse social groupings. So honestly, and the rest of the statement, and it's signed by 50, it's actually signed by 50 different trade unions, student radicals, and activists across Iran. Well, that was last year. I think the list has massively grown now. So we start to get a sense that there's some real organisation taking place. What Frieda said is really important to understand. The void is the lack of socialists with the kind of politics that Frieda talked about. So that's the case of all across the Middle East, but there is hope, comrades. There is hope. It's in the streets and it's in the workplaces.